Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. Welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability.
And this is Fred Schankelberg. And welcome back if you're a longtime or frequent listener, or if it's your first time, hey, join the conversation. We'd love to have you join in with our comments and ideas. We're recording this, obviously, and so you can listen to it at will. Yet you can chime in with ideas and suggestions over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And, you know, Adam, we were chatting briefly just as we're getting started for recording here, and you bought another or are in about to buy another car sight unseen and then drive it across the country. And it's one of these late model sports cars that are notoriously unreliable. So I question your wisdom.
It's not notoriously unreliable. It's an old Porsche. It's a 1970. If I do it, and it's.
Are you taking a toolkit with you?
Of course.
Yeah.
I keep toolkits in my wallet. I have. Okay. But no, it's very much a study in reliability, which I enjoy. I mean, even the one I did with the Datsun, I even looked up the original. I got the original reports in the late '60s when. You know, Datsun was testing their first car out in Western America because they didn't know what would be different there versus, you know, Japan. And this one's very much about if I do this one, it's very much going to be I'm going to talk a lot about it in my, articles and other things going forward, because it's so fascinating me, these strategies that people have had where Porsche has this idea of I know I say it the way the Americans do. I just because it sounds so obnoxious when you say Porsche, even though it's the way you're supposed to say it. Mm-hmm. You have to limit how obnoxious you appear when you're in the high-end cars. to try it.
Well, you're failing that miserably at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I like it from the engineering standpoint. I don't, you know. Their strategy, the Porsche strategy, has always been evolution, not revolution. You know, doing incremental improvements based on robustness testing, which is their racing programs. Mm-hmm. And to the point where their competitors, Enzo Ferrari said, you know, thank God it's only the 24 hours of Le Mans and 24 hours of Daytona. If it was the 48 hours, Porsche would be the only car to even finish.
Right.
You know, even the competitors acknowledge that. And so I think it's kind of cool then when the communities, the people who are passionate about it, continue to do that evolution on these older cars by taking updates Porsche has done in later years and retroactively putting them into older designs. And that's one of the things that interests me about this car.
Okay.
So there's a lot there.
Well, now, is it just becoming a better race car? Is it becoming more of what it originally intended to be? Or is it adding Wi-Fi capability finally?
No. It's combining the best parts of different years, I guess would be the way to say it. So taking the best parts from 1970, adding some of the best parts from 1978, a few of the best parts from 1984, you know, like that, and combining them all into one thing. And the reason why you'd say, well, why don't you just grab the car from 1990? Well, the problem is there's been so many other influences that were uncontrolled or forced by market strategy that took away from it.
Oh, so if they had a great suspension and then later they gave up on that to get some other features or functionality in there, then you would want the old suspension, but the new dashboard, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. The marketing team said, hey, if you soften the suspension by 10%, our market share will grow by 20% because a lot of people want to buy them and just drive them on the street. Well, now for the guys who love them are pissed that the suspension isn't as tunable or something, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. But yet, obviously, the more advanced, they began doing something different with the oil cooling system that improved that. So it's kind of neat, this idea of a sub-assembly pick and choose for the passionate community. And when they start doing this kind of what's called a resto mod, where you restore a car but modifications to it based on other available technology. So I find that fascinating, of course, as a reliability engineer, because it's the continuation of making it more reliable through testing. And the testing is everybody out there beating the crap out of them.
Well, it brings up an issue, though, because how do you design a car to work? And I've run into this with a client recently, is that they're not making cars. it was funny. I was sitting down with a group of them, and I was talking about you need to set a reliability goal, and it has four elements. And they're like, what are those? And went down functionality, environment, probability, and duration. And they had me go over it, and I ended up doing a small class on it. And they said, well, what do you mean by function? I said, well, what's your product supposed to do? You know, how does your customer expect to use it? And oh, by the way, your customer is more than likely going to exceed your expectations of how to use it.
So use case 7.
Yeah, exactly. We were talking about that in the last podcast. Is that all of those elements change, but functionality is we often see it as a, and I'm sure Porsche had this at some stage, an engineering requirements document, a huge document that listed it, size, color, weight, strength, reflectivity, you know, speed, all these technical features that had to be in that product. Yet the hard part is that it's not fixed, right? You demonstrate that with this modifications, I think it was.
Retro mod,
right? Yeah. Where people are saying, well, yeah, that's a great function, and I like this other function too. Let's put them together, or let's extend it a little bit, or let's change it a little bit. Let's add some other functionality to it. Is that I don't think is ever going away, yet it creates a dilemma for when we want to create a specification for a product, and part of that is used in the reliability targets or goals is, well, here's what the function is. Here's what we need it to do. When I push this button, the green light should come on, right? And then if we want to lock it down so we can actually create a product at some point, yet we also want it to be flexible. So yeah. I get this dilemma going here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and I really don't, I mean, some, I mean, being a car guy and a Porsche guy, but I'm not a Porsche guy blindly loyal. I mean, I can give you very specific cases or examples of, you know, things I cite, but they somehow always figured out how to do that. They could set criteria that were extremely diverse and still satisfy it. So back in the late 80s, they made the Porsche 959, which was this a car that was a supercar that could do 200 miles an hour and all these amazing things for back then, but it also could be used off-road. Think about how insane that is. You could hit a button on the dash and the suspension would rise a couple inches. And what they did is with this car that on the racetrack could beat other race cars, they also put it in the Paris to Dakar rally, mm-hmm. which is a desert mountain rally. And they won that too in the same car. Wow. And so somehow they set the specifications to where it could do both. And I can't even imagine what that design process was like. How do you set that as specifications? And the engineers are like, okay, do it. And that's diverse.
I had a Citroen that did that. It was a hydraulic system, and it would change the feel of the suspension. It would raise it like almost a foot. It went from
That was the CM, because it had a Maserati motor in it. So it had the M in the name. I know Citroen did that, but that was for different reasons. That was for self-leveling and stuff like that. I'm not just talking about the suspension raising. I mean, being able to handle like true dune stuff and all that.
It was by no means a race car or an off-road car.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm on the Autobahn, I'd lower it and the steering would get tighter, the suspension would get tighter, but I had very little clearance and the roads were good. So you could deal with that. Whereas it started snowing and I needed to park in a snowbank, I'd raise it up and drive right up on top of it. I have four-wheel drive and we could park anywhere.
I've actually worked on that that system specifically, suspension, because I had a friend of mine who was crazy passionate about those.
Imagine parts are hard to find. That was one.
Oh, you had to make you basically had to make your own stuff, right? Right. Yeah, pretty much.
To your cars, they knew that they wanted to create that variability in use cases and create it all in one car. So
how do you do that? I can't even picture how you set such diverse specifications and do it and commit to it in a project. You know, what do you do when you hit roadblocks where you can only seem to do one or the other? Do you compromise? And I don't know.
And part of it, I've seen this in products I've worked with at HP, is that you would create deliberately design a platform, a family. And then knowing that you still got to make this deadline, we're only going to put in 50% of the functionality, and then there's a roadmap for adding the other stuff. But the initial main motherboard, for example, would have all this extra space that then could be mechanically would fit the form and function of the, or the space that was allocated to it, yet had enough room to accommodate future expansion, which wasn't designed yet. Yeah. So there was some of that strategy going on to it, is one way to think about it. But what you're talking about is you got to understand that those two use cases. And I agree with you that there are cases where they will contradict each other. You can't get there from both.
Yeah.
Unless you're very, very creative, which apparently these guys were.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. In new product development, setting the specifications, yeah, you need them to drive you, you know, to creating this, you know, the high, something high end and highly functional, but you have to be careful of the, you know, how they can limit you as well. Cause I see them also, cause great program issues. You push too much technology at the same time, let's say, you know, several features, and then you get to the point where the way you've had to split your investment, none of them are stable, you know, the end, and then you're unreliable, right? That's that balance between developing functionality, program time, reliability, cost point. Something has to give. So actually, that would be an interesting thing. I wonder if I could ever find out what schedule slips they had for that, for that program, because they did it as a test bed. I mean, they only made like, I don't think like 200 of those cars because they had to satisfy race regulations. Mm-hmm. So it was never intended to be a production, you know, high volume production car. So what they then did is slowly bled that technology into the production cars to where even 10 years later or longer, mm-hmm. they were putting features in cars that were from that car that were still cutting edge at the time, you know? How do you do that in a program? So actually, wait a minute. Maybe I just answered the question, actually. Forget it. Wait, I might have just answered the question where you could do an inventive program and then slowly put those features into production over longer periods of time where they get the long-term validation and, you know, the reliability maturity periods.
Yeah. You know, and it's one of the things I saw at IBM and at Bell Labs, and GM did this a little bit. HP certainly did it. I saw it at Microsoft, those are ones that come to mind. And I've seen it in a few startups also, where they have a carved out a bit of their R&D time to do these, like, concept cars is what I would like to call them, although I think they've lost their true value through the marketing world. But at HP, it would be, we're going to create a concept and get it to feasibility that we can do these functions. And what they found is that almost invariably is these concepts were great technical breakthroughs, right, to solve some unknown problem. And then it took the rest of the organization to figure out, well, what are we going to do with this? How do we actually make this into a product that anybody would want? And some never see the light of day. But one of those ideas was inkjet printers. These guys were, how can we produce a printing without this laser printing engine that we have to buy from Canon? Let's figure out another way to print, and let's spit the ink. Let's throw the ink at the page. How crazy is that?
You know? Right.
And now, and now it's morphed into printing three-dimensional bone replacement components that you can do in surgery, right? And all kinds of other stuff they're doing. And they were doing 3D printing with inkjet printer technology. Oh, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Yeah. It's amazing how it's evolved. Yet the idea of, well, here's a function, right? And we're going to create it and we're going to experiment with it. And in Porsche, in the racing world, is they use that kind of like a Hall test, you think?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's definitely the, you know, you're definitely testing your, you know, it's a really great stress margin test and endurance, right? What do wear out pheromones look like? And the thing is, you get you don't just have the opportunity to make things overly robust. You have to make them exactly robust because you don't want to carry extra weight, right? So the perfect, you know, actually, it's funny. The Ferdinand Porsche's quote is saying the perfect race car falls apart right after the finish line. Because that would be the perfect design. I mean, you perfectly understood the stress to pheromone relationships, right? And you didn't carry one extra bolt or one extra ounce of weight. And you can optimize the design from there.
He must have read the One Hoss Shay by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Are you familiar with that poem?
No, I'm not.
I think it's like in Boston. I think it's set in Boston, actually, the poem is. But it's the this I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Is this guy was fed up with having to replace the carriage or the struts or the wheel or the axle or you know, the springs or whatever on his carriage. This is, he had a one horse drawn carriage to get around, and this is in the late 1800s, and he was tired of fixing one thing after another. Does this sound familiar at all to you, Adam?
A little bit.
Yeah, fixing things one after another. And so he decided he was going to make his own shay. So he used the best possible materials and hardest woods and the best forged irons and the best craftsmen and all this stuff. And he made every single part to be as robust as, or as strong as every other part, is I think the way he phrased it. And it lasted for 100 years in one day. And then the whole thing collapsed into a pile of dust because everything failed simultaneously. Hmm. And so it was the, as far as I know, it's the earliest reference to reliability engineering.
Interesting.
It's just what Porsche said, right? If you finish the race and then it just gasps for breath and fades away into uselessness. It just crashes.
Yeah.
It gives it all. Now, if we could buy a coffee machine or a washing machine or a computer that we knew with exactitude that it would last 10 years, and then the day after 10 years, it would just be worthless. That would be valuable, right? If it had no failures for that period of time and then total failure after that, it would be so predictable.
But impossible, because reliability is centered around the study and control of variability. So mm-hmm. to say that would happen for the entire population means that for every single use case, environment, and manufacturing variability, that same thing happens. That means there's no variability.
Yeah.
So I think the in my mind, the true trick in real life is, you know, that's the zero defects idea, right? It falls apart the day after, you know, it's after 10 years.
Right.
But in reality, it's studying those variabilities and controlling them well enough that only the percentage of the tail of the variability you want to have go before that cutoff point is there, right?
Right. And then there's guys like you, use case seven, that are
use case seven
that will either use it longer or use it in conditions beyond that expected variability. And that's where the rub is that in the design teams, we're looking at what's our functionality, what's our uses, and so on. And we're bounding that artificially. Well,
I'm in there, but I'm on the tail, right? And that's I'm that tail that crosses over the line you want, where you're like, forget it, I don't care about that guy.
That's right.
that's me. Right? I mean, you know, you can't say a normal distribution is entirely past some cutoff point because it goes on to infinity, right?
Right.
You decide where you're going to cut it off, and that's what you do your statistics to. And, you know, I'm on the other side of that cutoff line, and you're just like, yeah, well, whatever, that guy's, you know, that guy's, we're doing use case 1 through 6, forget him.
So. That's right. We should give you the product early on, because then you'll find out where the leading edge of that tail is.
Fred, I've made an entire career around that. A lot of people do that. that's my profession. Remember?
That's right.
I'm a consultant. That's, they hire me. They're like, here, give it to Adam. We'll see what happens. I'm like the gorilla in the room. When, remember those old Samsonite commercials?
Yeah.
They gave it to the gorilla, and they're like, man, it seems all right after he smashed the hell out of it. That's me.
Yeah. I wonder how many they had to give to the gorilla before the gorilla got bored of it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Now, it's a challenge. In the design process, we have to create something that does something. And then you and I walk into the room and go, well, how's it not going to do that? We put a not sign in front of it and try to break it a dozen different ways. And the hard part is that how do you create an adaptable functionality to those different use cases simultaneously with still getting a good enough product out the door? And that example with the Porsche, this car that I suspect you're talking yourself and Beth into getting, is a study in that, isn't it? It's here's an experimental car, essentially, that proved so many cool ideas, and then it got amalgamated again into here's the best of the best. And
right.
Do they ever make cars that are based on that kind of technology? Because they make the concept car, you know, that original race car, and then it gets distributed out to all the models, do they then take the best of those various innovations and then compile it into another race car?
Well, you have to be, if we're talking race car or production car, because in both cases, there's a lot of other inputs, right? So it's what we're doing is with the Resto mod is creating a playing field where the only contributing voice is the engineer, right? Mm-hmm. Because
as it should be.
If you're talking about the production cars, then you have a lot of other voices. What's going to sell? And they're all very important voices. But mm-hmm. what's going to gain the most market share? What's going to satisfy this? Okay, what's going to satisfy the safety requirements where you have to be able to hit a pedestrian at 10 miles an hour, and this happens, and mm-hmm. So all those voices are there too, and you end up with a compromise that's the best one for the program. Or in racing, you have to satisfy regulations, or what are the limiting factors? You can't have 4,000 horsepower cars all on their track. It's doing 300 miles an hour. The fatalities would be crazy.
Right.
You want to set guidelines to compete in certain design and skill. So that's what you're seeing in all those cases is a balance where the engineers say, here's the best of the best, combine this, this, and this. And then somebody else says, okay, but you can't have, fuel mileage of 5 miles per gallon. So you can have and you come up with, you balance it out.
Right.
And you get great. And I should say too, a lot of great engineering innovations have come out of those constraints. I mean, it's amazing. It used to be that there was such a concern back in the 70s that cars were going to be crap in the future because mm-hmm. of fuel mileage restrictions, right?
Right.
And there, Corvettes had like 170 horsepower, like less than a Honda Civic now, because they didn't know how, fuel mileage restrictions were done, and they didn't know how to handle it.
Right.
But what that did is that forced them to innovate in being able to make combustion more efficient, to where now you can go to a Dodge dealership and buy a Dodge Hellcat that has 700 horsepower and gets like 20 miles per gallon.
Right.
It's because of that challenge, So it is interesting to see what happens. But yeah, the whole Resto mod idea is that kind of fun thing of only the engineering voice exists, and what would I pick and choose? So
well, that's cool. We'll look forward to all those parts and pieces of it. And listening to the show, if you'd like to chime in with some ideas or place a wager on whether this car will make it across country after Adam buys it. head over to sendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And we do listen to those. We have created quite a few episodes based on ideas and suggestions there. And so we'd love to hear from you on that. And I think, Adam, I don't know what proportion of shows we've done on in Kirk too. If things around the house, we've talked about your boat. We've talked about your various cars, your workshop. I think he's had multiple blenders, TV sets going bad, a circuit breaker. I think he was hovering over the repairman as he took it apart. You guys are never for the lack of creating new use case 7. That's the right word.
Do you like that? That's my new term. I think I need to copyright it. Use case seven. I'm going to start doing some specific articles and.
Well, trademark.
Other posts. Yeah, I'll trademark it. Use case seven. It's the tail of the curve.
it's how I use products. That's what you're going to be your tagline.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck getting through the rest of the day. I'm glad I'm not trying to service the warranty in your place. That'd be good. All right, Adam. Well, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Take care. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.